All the items seem to be in place. Yeah. I have my beverage, my phone, my pad of paper, the script, my computer, and most importantly, guests. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable for this 13th day of November. It is a delight to have you with us. 12 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we have a great group to talk about some very important stories that have taken place. And we're going to do just that. We welcome you, as always, to join in. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Quick shout out, I was at an event last night at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut, to talk to my dear friends. Sandra Boynton, the wonderful illustrator, cartoonist, is an amazing figure in cartoonism. And she and her son, Dylan McEwen, who was an Olympian, for goodness sakes, he wrote a cocktail book for like a year's worth of holidays. And so if you want to celebrate Talk Like a Pirate Day, these are the cocktails that you'd have on that day, you see, or Halloween or Thanksgiving, or, of course, you know, the holidays coming up. We went and we had a brilliant time. It was a full house. It was great to see everybody out there, and everybody was in a good mood. Everybody was happy. We were, which had nothing to do with the alcohol, I'm sure. And it was just really a wonderful, wonderful time. And so my thanks to Oblong Books. They're wonderful people. They're so wonderful that I left my bag with my computer and my wallet in it, and they're actually bringing it up to me today. So that's really sweet of them, and I thank them very much for that. But I also want to thank Sandy and Dylan for doing the event last night. It was such fun, and we had a really, really good time. But and I didn't think on my way home, which like it takes me about 2 hours to get home, and I was talking to my wife on the phone, and I didn't think like anything could sort of highlight that event. As Kelly said, you sound like you're up, like you're on a high. I was like, yeah, you can't beat that. And then I saw the Northern Lights. Oh my God, that was I've never seen that before. I don't know. Have you all seen it?
Only vaguely,
dimly.
No, just look at that.
Wow.
Yeah, it just looks like the sky was on fire. And I'm showing a picture of, this is in Berlin, and it was really incredible. And this is like behind, it was amazing, just really, really stunning. So I was so excited to get home, and yet I stopped every 4 minutes to take photos, so it took me like 3 hours to get home.
And you didn't use any special filters on those?
No. The phone just grabs them. It's really good. So, but hopefully you got to see them, because it was just extraordinary. I've never seen anything like that. It was a beautiful, beautiful ride home. We have a lot to talk about. We'll get right to it. Let me introduce the group to you. Ira Fussfeld is here. It's always a better day when Ira is here. And publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. Good morning, my friend. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for the kind words. Good morning to everybody else. And listen, if it's all right with you, if I have nothing interesting to say today and I just say 67, will that be okay?
You say 6-7.
See, I'm already starting off in the wrong place. 6-7.
Yeah, 6-7. Yeah,
nobody knows what that means.
Not really, no.
Okay, well, I'll use it on occasion.
It means nothing anyway. So.
Yeah, it was explained to me by my 20-year-old nieces and nephews, and even they were like,
that's right up my alley. Then nobody knows what I say, even when I try to say something. So I'll just cut it short and say 6-7.
No, you're fine. Whatever you come up with is a winner, Ira. You know that.
All right. Well, we'll see.
Judy Patrick joins us, former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning, and now I'm going to be wondering all day what this cocktail would be for Pirate Day.
It involved squid.
Rum?
Involves, I think it involves squid and squid ink.
No parents.
No, parents. No parents. I don't. I think
the cocktail.
Well, you liquefy.
Yeah, that's true. It was, but it was. Yeah, I'll show it to you. It's pretty cool. Nick Rangel joins us, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Good morning, Nick. How are you?
I'm doing great. And if my mom is listening, this is a great Christmas present idea because I also want to know what a pirate cocktail is.
It's so handy. It's just cocktails for every day, all the time, really cool things. And it's, yeah, it was a lot of fun. Good stuff. We tried, I think, three different ones. There were some mocktails and cocktails, and so, but just very, very a good time. And yeah, I think you'll enjoy seeing the possibilities. And then, of course, it's all with Sandra Boynton's art, which she's just the best. So let's go to stories and find out what's happening in this world. And the big story, of course, is we had the shutdown. For a long, long time. It was the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. 43 days. And it did cause disruption, and it did cause a lot of delays. But as of last night, the President of the United States signed a bill to reopen the U.S. government. Many federal workers are expected back to work today. So, the longest government shutdown in history is over. And speaking from the White House late Wednesday, Trump blamed the shutdown and its harmful effects squarely on the Democratic Party and portrayed its end as a Republican victory. He also urged voters to remember the shutdown ahead of the 2026 midterm elections, as if there's not a possibility for another shutdown before the 2026 midterms. But I digress. An apparent attempt to use the moment as political leverage, despite recent polls suggesting that more Americans do blame the GOP than the Democrats for the shutdown. This is no way to run a country. I hope we will all agree that the government should never be shut down again, Trump said in a live broadcast. He pledged to pass legislation to end politicians' ability to filibuster and send the federal government will, quote, now resume normal operations. Your interpretation of what normal operations...
It's the good news and the bad news.
Right, whatever that is. Earlier in the day, the House voted to reopen federal agencies, the first time it had been in session in nearly 8 weeks. House Speaker Mike Johnson had kept the chamber out of session since September 19th in a bid to pressure the Senate to agree to a GOP funding extension, which Senate Democrats had repeatedly rejected. Lawmakers voted 222 to 209 to reopen the government yesterday. The plan approved Wednesday was brokered over the weekend between Senate Republicans, 7 Senate Democrats, and 1 independent. It passed the upper chamber Monday night. We feel very relieved. The Democrat shutdown is finally over, Johnson told reporters after the House vote earlier Wednesday. All this was utterly pointless and foolish. This outcome was totally foreseeable. They got nothing for their selfish political stunt. That reporting from the Washington Post. Nick Rangel, what do you make of this?
Well, I guess, firstly, I think Mike Johnson is incorrect in his assessment that the Democrats got nothing for the shutdown. When the shutdown first started, the Republicans were very skillful at placing the blame on the Democrats, and the vast majority of Americans blamed the Democrats. And as the shutdown continued, it became more and more clear that the majorities in both houses were not negotiating, not open to conversations, were out on recess, and were more than willing to allow people to go hungry instead of meeting Democrats at the table. And while it is true Democrats didn't get very much in the end in the bill itself, they did get some. They got SNAP funding for the whole year. They got people's jobs reinstated. They got back pay guaranteed for those federal employees, which were things that were not guaranteed without those concessions. And while they won't win the vote on healthcare vouchers, it is much more clear to most voters that their healthcare costs are going up because of choices that the Republicans are making, which was not clear at the beginning of the shutdown. So I think all of those things are political wins for the Democrats. How they leverage it is another question, but I do think that they got more than the speaker is pronouncing.
Judy Patrick.
You know, I hate the fact that the media frames this as who won, who lost, who's to blame, who's not to blame, but that's how the politicians are framing it and couching it. That being said, I think the Democrats, I agree with Nick, I think the Democrats came out ahead in large part because the ACA, the health insurance funding issue, is not resolved, and people are going to have to start paying more, or they're going to have no insurance at all, and that will reverberate all through next year during the midterm campaigns, and so, and that will that will benefit the Democrats. It's very clear. Also, can I just say that Mike Johnson spent the last 6 weeks telling us that he wanted people to vote on a clean CR with nothing else in it. But guess what was in this CR that they passed? It was this provision that allows the senators to sue for up to $500,000 because they're upset that Jack Smith may have subpoenaed their phone records. I mean, it wasn't just CR. They put some other stuff on it, contrary to what Mike Johnson said he was going to do. So
he claims to have been unaware of that until he saw it. Until he saw it, he didn't know they were going to do that.
Unaware until he read it.
You know, I was aware of it. Yeah. Read the news.
Yes, if only there was not an outlet to find out this information. Ira.
Well, I don't know. There's so many ways to go on this. And as you alluded, in January, the end of January, we may be right back where we are now. But I sort of was interested, and it piggybacks on what the others have said about the messaging here. The Republicans are very good at messaging and very good at drilling the same lines over and over to the point where you've hypnotized the public. And so every other sentence was, it's a Schumer shutdown. It's Democrats' fault. But those words to the contrary, generally speaking, the Democrats are getting more favorable reaction than not. I mean, I know a number of Democrats were upset about how they think that Schumer gave in. But I think that the point that the Democrats needed to make was made, and the health care issue is a significant one, and it shouldn't be brushed off as the Republicans seem to have done. The other thing that interested me is that you may have read the story in the Washington Post a day or two ago about what Trump was doing during this whole time. Unlike past presidents who had to correctly saw the need to get themselves involved to try to come to an agreement, Trump was out golfing. He was traveling the world. He was destructing the White House, the East Wing. So I don't think yesterday was a good day for him. Although at the end of the day, he'll continue to say it was the Democrats' fault.
We have a letter from a listener who said, I saw Mike Johnson's remarks. Every word out of his mouth was a lie. Well, I don't know. I mean, it was they're certainly pushing the point that it was not the Republicans. The president did the same thing when he was signing the bill last night. And I don't want to pile on, because whenever we say anything like this, we just get a lot of mean letters, and those are just from Teresa. But
our Teresa,
yeah, our Teresa. But you know, to blame, but to say that, you know, certainly Democrats are doing the same thing of casting the blame, and I don't saying that it's the fault of Republicans, and I think Judy pointed this out. It's just this back and forth of whose fault it was, instead of trying to come to some understanding of how we avoid it and maybe avoid it to the point where we don't have to go through this again at the end of January.
Well, you know, the Congress can negotiate the budget bills earlier before it is past due. That is a surprising trick of the trade. You could just start negotiating before it expires. We've been on a continuing resolution for over a year now, because this whole year was a continuing resolution and last year was a continuing resolution. So Congress hasn't passed and adopted a new federal budget in 2 years. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah. And so in this instance, over the summer, the House went on a pretty long recess. They weren't there to do the work of negotiating a budget. They were unable to get a budget between the majority conferences in the House and in the Senate. Their budgets are billions of dollars apart, like their proposals. Those two majority conferences have still been unable to get two-way agreement on a spending proposal. I doubt they'll be able to do so in a month. And we're going to be in this situation again because the House has not been in Washington to do the work of negotiating a budget with their majority counterparts in the Senate.
Hey, and also, they're going to take off at the end of the day. They'll be back next week for a few days. And then they've got a Thanksgiving recess. This from a group that's been off since September. I mean, I have often said I don't think the people in Congress work very hard. They'll say, Mike Johnson was saying, all our members are back home doing constituent services. You know what I'd love to see? I'd love to see a daily diary of what every congressperson does. We should make that public so their constituents can see how hard they're working or not.
Well, they're very defensive about that. I mean, I can recall not just congressmen, but with state legislators, when you'd say that you're rarely in session, aren't you guys working? And they would say, oh, we're doing constituent services and we're doing this and we're doing that. And I suspect that it's true to a certain point, but they ought to be mindful of the importance of me showing up in Washington and do the government's business. You were going to say.
Yeah, I would just say they didn't cancel their legislative days in the House. There were legislative days. They counted those legislative days towards their legislative calendar, but they didn't have any bills on any of those legislative days. They haven't passed a bill since September 19th, I think. It is conceivable that on a non-session day, the lawmakers are still working towards negotiating a bill. They're still getting presentations by their staff or updates from staff. They're giving directions to staff on what to do next. That doesn't happen when they're actually in their district. And I think the distinction is important. You can have non-legislative days or days that you're not in session, but you are in D.C. and you are working on these bills. But when you send people back to Alaska, like, it is far less likely that you are both getting updates on negotiations and also providing feedback on what those budget bills are going to look like. And I think that technical work, it has to be in the Capitol.
Well, and even aside from the showdown and the issues that arise, I think a fair complaint is in the last couple of decades, and I'm not sure where the line of demarcation is, the congressmen and senators are in town for several days, and then they immediately go home, and then that means that they're not interacting with themselves. They're not having dinner. They're not
that you know of. Well, I'm going to stop you there. Yeah, okay. We just have to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. The shutdown is over. How's that for a headline? And we're talking about it on the roundtable panel this morning. Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, Nick Rangel with us, and we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We have a couple letters here. We welcome yours. As a spouse of a staffer to a Democratic U.S. senator of whom I have a critique, writes Matt, I can assure you negotiations happen no matter where the member is. If the member is of a mind to negotiate, furthermore, much negotiation happens between senior staffers across committees and member offices. So I believe the point being made by Matt is you don't have to be in Washington, D.C. at the, say, the Rayburn Building to make to make stuff happen.
Yeah, but I'm obviously not one of them, but people who have experienced this in a different time will remind you that when they did get together, when they did go, when they 5 o'clock came and they went and had a couple of cocktails, and the senators and Congress people got to know each other, the tone of the Congress was better, the production of the Congress was better, and the ratcheting down of tensions in the country was better.
And the COVID work from home argument continues, right?
I was just going to make one other point. If the Senate and the President and the Congress want to score some points, and I presume that they can do this, they must put an amendment or rewrite the law so that federal workers who are actually out there working are being paid while they're working. I don't believe that the rank and file of this nation would dispute the fact that the TSA agents and the air traffic controllers, to name two, if they were going to come in, they shouldn't have been asked to come in for no pay, even though they were going to get back pay, because a lot of them are going hand to mouth. I don't know why that rule exists, but it's a bad rule and it ought to be changed.
And at least it was negotiated within this agreement that was voted on last night.
Well, it was negotiated that they'll get paid for what they've done, but come January 30th, if there's another shutdown, we're back to where we are.
6-7, Ira.
6-7.
6-7.
I just want to respond. Spent many years on central staff in the state Senate negotiating bills in counsel's office. And I am not disputing that negotiations can't happen remotely. What I am doubling down on is what Ira mentioned, is that moving large budget bills is exponentially quicker and more efficient when people are all there. You have conference together. You talk about confidential debates in closed session, in closed conference. You deal with those really sticky conversations in person. It was evident that any negotiations were crawling at a snail's pace while the House was sent on recess. And there are reports of that all over the press.
Right. And I mean, Not to be Captain Obvious here, but that's everything is shut down, right? I mean, that's sort of the point of it, in the sense of it is what it is billed to be. Let's go to I didn't finish Matt's letter, and I apologize. There, Matt was making the point that you could negotiate from anywhere, but saying there is plenty to critique about U.S. Congress, but the broad brush is about what work is being done and when are often quite incorrect. That said, plenty was not happening because some were clearly not of a mind to let it happen these past many weeks. That from Matt. Then we go to Craig. With the first comment, the vast majority of Americans did not blame Democrats for the shutdown. On the contrary, from The Hill, the publication, November 2nd, most voters in a new survey blame either President Trump or Republicans in Congress for the federal shutdown, which has now stretched into its second month. In an NBC poll conducted in late October, 52% of voters say Trump and or the Republican Party is responsible for the federal shutdown, including 25% who blame congressional Republicans, 24% who blame Trump, and 3% who say they blame both, even after they were asked to select between the two. I think you can find whatever numbers you want to find in polls that are out there. I will say, Craig, that as you note in your letter about this from The Hill on November 2nd, a lot of this came from the exit polling that was taken at the time of the election on Election Day. And the polls that were generated from that seem to show that the Democrats, and again, they were also, the Democrats did well. So it would make sense to say that was going to be the result of the poll. But I think when that is used, it's not that it's incorrect. It's just that that's where that information comes from.
Right. That timeline is independent of the shutdown. Although I think if the Democrats had voted to end the shutdown before that election, they would not have done as well.
And one of my points is that if the media spends so much time figuring out who's to blame or who America blames, they spend less time talking about the real issues involved or what's actually happening or what's happening behind the scenes. I mean, the repercussions of this, or why aren't they adopting a budget at a regular time frame like cities and towns and counties are doing right now, you know, getting a budget in place before the start of the fiscal year. I'm just saying too much media focus is on winners and losers and not enough on the real consequences.
Well,
in the media do.
Yeah, some in the media was what the second sentence I was going to say. Yeah. But the first sentence was, I think that the media writ large is doing better on this point. Yes, you have stories about polling, and it's part of the story, but I don't see them ignoring the crux issues. So I think it's possible to have your cake and eat it. I think it's difficult as the media finds itself with fewer people and is more split than it used to be. But I think when this issue about horse races and polling came up years ago, since then, you can see there has been less of an emphasis.
Ross writes, spin, 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 spin. Panelists, who are you kidding? Just yesterday, Democrats were furious that three Democratic senators broke rank and sided with Republicans. The House of Cards fell. Today, you're trying to spin a Democratic win from this shutdown. I don't know that we were doing that, but okay. The Dems got hammered again. Well, yeah.
I mean, they're the minority conference, right? And I don't think there was a universe where the Dems didn't fold, because they don't hold the cards to that House of Cards. The only question is, when would have been the most ideal moment for that to happen? And there's some debate about how much longer would have been more effective for their long-term, you know, midterm election impact. I would say we're not in a great spot with a very short-term CR to the end of the year. We're already seeing lots of uncertainty in RFPs and RFAs going out around, you know, pre-applications.
What's an RFP and an RFA?
Well, so like grant applications, we're being invited to apply, to pre-apply for grants that today we have no idea will or won't be funded in a budget, because we don't have a budget, and it is unlikely that they will pass a CR to keep funding level from this last year, given kind of the narrative that we've heard from the majority conferences. So I think the Democrats did almost just as well as they could have done with the shutdown as a political tool, and I don't know that there's a whole lot better outcome for Democrats.
The skeptic in me, when the eight Democrats or the seven Democrats and one independent broke ranks with the rest of the Democrats, the skeptic in me said, isn't that amazing that they needed eight to get to 60 to 40 in that vote, and they got eight, and they've taken a few brickbats. But the overall reaction here and most places is that the Democrats came out okay here. They defended the health care as best they could and got it on the radar. I wonder, as I say, it's the skeptic in me. I wonder how well planned this was for this very outcome to have happened, even though it looks like the most of the Democrats, including leadership, is mad at those in the Republican and the Democratic Party who didn't stick with them. I wonder how mad they are.
Well, I think that was a part of the problem that Schumer was facing in the calls to resign, was that many people felt that he had his fingerprints all over the bringing together of the eight,
right?
And then at the same time was giving him cover to complain about the fact that it was that this group was moving forward.
Yeah, the Democratic social media network exploded on Sunday night when this news broke. And let's be clear, it happened on a Sunday night when nobody was paying attention. It makes you a little suspicious, but I mean, people felt disillusioned. They thought the Democrats were going to hold the Trump administration to account, and they didn't want to give up the fight. And they were disillusioned. And I can understand that's where they're coming from. But the reality was they had no cards. They had no hand, as we would say. And they were never going to win this fight. I mean, they got a promise that there will be a vote on the ACA. Well, guess what that vote's going to be? They're not going to extend these health care subsidies. They're not going to release the Epstein files. There's certain things. All the Democrats can do at this point is engineer votes to put people on the record.
We will take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, and Nick Rangel. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. This from the New York Times reporting, with the federal government reopening, monthly benefits will soon flow again to the roughly 42 million low-income Americans who rely on Washington to purchase groceries. But the damage wrought by days of delays and a crisis that President Trump had refused to resolve is likely to prove longer lasting. For the poorest Americans, the end of the longest shutdown in U.S. history on Wednesday seemed unlikely to quell their doubt and anxiety, with their faith shaken in the food stamp program and in the reliability of the federal government to serve as a social safety net. Never before had there been such an interruption to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, a decades-old initiative that serves about one in eight Americans, but the lapse is experienced during the 43-day federal stoppage, seemed to erode the fundamental guarantee that the government would protect the most vulnerable families from harm. A total breakdown in the nation's largest anti-hunger program might have been unfathomable in past shutdowns and under prior administrations. But Mr. Trump promised throughout the fiscal stalemate to slash programs favored by Democrats. He spoke openly about using the core functions of government as a form of political leverage, while his administration refused to tap ample leftover funds to provide full food stamps this month. Mr. Trump's aides opposed any requirement that they disburse complete aid, threatening states and mounting a legal fight that it twice took to the Supreme Court. Even on Monday, as the Senate worked to reopen the government, the administration continued to resist. In at least one state, Mr. Trump's actions threatened to shut off the cards used by families to buy groceries, according to local officials who pressed ahead with a lawsuit to force the release of benefits.
So you had the compassionate Trump, rather than say to the legislatures, we've got to get this done because we've got people in this country, the richest country in the world, who can't afford to have food, and we're making it worse. And of course, Trump did that. He was the compassionate. Oh, wait a minute. No, that wasn't him.
Nick, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the point is to shift the notion in the American eye or the American opinion that the federal government will take care of its poorest and most vulnerable people. I think that's what the intention is. The administration's been clear that it doesn't believe the federal government should be considered a reliable source for poor and vulnerable people for support. We're seeing, a shift and a politicization of many programs, right? The HUD, COC programs around supportive housing, permanent housing, and short-term housing, those are being politicized right now as well. We've seen the release of new guidance and new rules around which organizations and which kinds of programs will be prioritized in the HUD grant application funding process, which would start funding in January 2026. We're just kind of now getting those formal rules rolled out. And those rules shift more than half of the funding that currently supports permanent housing to short-term housing programs, which means in the Capital Region, many supportive housing and permanent housing programs will completely lose funding or will lose a tremendous amount of their funding and will have to shift to different types of housing. What that means is supportive and permanent housing houses disabled people who are homeless or at risk of homelessness for more than 2 years. Many of those folks are there for, you know, over 8 years. This program is shifting more than half of those funds to move disabled people out of permanent housing into something else faster. The problem is there isn't something else to move people to. People with disabilities don't have enough household income to afford the average or the median rents in any locality, really. The rents are higher than the household incomes of most of our poor and vulnerable people. People are spending, you know, 50% of their household income on rent if they aren't in these kind of supportive and permanent housing programs. The federal administration's also shifting funding away from cities that it considers sanctuary cities and towards cities that have passed, affirmatively passed, legislation that criminalizes or bans outdoor sleeping or homelessness. So where programs exist in cities like Albany, this administration would defund those programs in order to fund a program that's in a city like Saratoga, a city that is more well off and has a lower poverty rate than the city of Albany, but meets the administration's criteria, and then would also defund the programs doing long-term housing, even if they are in Saratoga, and shift those funds to short-term housing programs. This is I can't pronounce anything today.
I'm
trying to bring two words together.
You can borrow 6-7 if you want.
6-7, man. But it, you know, it completely shifts the paradigm around the housing network that exists across the country. You add that on top of the other funding instability. For example, my program, Legal Services Corporation, we don't know still what kind of funding LSC will have in the next year because there's not a budget and the CR only goes to the end of the year, right? So like all of these funding programs are very much in the air. SNAP benefits are funded for the year in this deal, the Democrat deal. That doesn't mean that you can force an agency to spend the money it's appropriated, which is a large part of the battle over the budget negotiations, is even if Democrats can get their programs funded, they've been unable or had a lot of difficulty forcing those agencies to spend the money it's been appropriated. And that sort of disingenuous negotiation style makes it really difficult to know what to rely on.
You know, housing has been a problem even, you know, for our generation. I can remember it was 10 years ago when they had the sign-ups for Section 8 housing. They stretch around blocks, and you know, in the city of Schenectady, for example. On the food stamps, this is, I went back through the food stamp history to try to get a sense of, because I remember it being expanded and then being contracted. And in the Big Beautiful Bill, it's contracted again. So new rules about food stamps take effect, I think, in January, which makes it more difficult for people to get food stamps in it. All encapsulates the Republican notion. The Republican notion that people, you know, don't deserve this, or people are you know, there's waste, fraud, and corruption here. That you've got able-bodied men sitting on basement couches playing video games and collecting food stamps. It's a recurrent theme that people don't believe that everybody who gets food stamps are entitled to them, or they want to control what they can buy. I think what, from my perspective, is coming from, you need to give people the dignity to be able to feed their family how they want to feed and not be so judgmental. And I think that pervades this whole food stamp discussion, is some judgment about poor people, about people who need help, and the government's obligation. And I also believe the federal government would like nothing more than to shift all the cost of this to the states and let the states decide who gets food stamps and who doesn't and how much they get, and take that completely off the federal government's plate.
Well, you spend a lot of time on the fund drive, Joe, with food, helping the food banks. What do they say as it relates to SNAP?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. I mean, one is that obviously you're seeing the need grow, skyrocket. The other thing that their point is, and I think it's a very good one, is that this was never meant to be the system. This was meant to be to help people who fell through the cracks, to help people who did not fit into the programs. And what has happened is that it has become the system. It has become the food banks and the food pantries become the system. And I think that's the problem. And we see this in a lot of different programs, government programs. But, yeah, instead of saying if you're gonna take away SNAP and then say, okay, well, you don't need SNAP because we're going to you can always go to your local food pantry, and then they don't have the food and they don't have the money and they don't have the funding. Well, then what do?
And grocery costs are just let's not talk about affordable. Let's just say the word expensive. It's expensive to buy bread. It's expensive to buy orange juice, the basics. It's really expensive to buy meat and fish and healthy food. I mean, the cost has skyrocketed in the last couple of years. And the food stamp allocation has not. I mean, I can't imagine if you had a limited amount of money, what you would do to feed like teenagers. I mean, they are voracious, and these new rules cap off food stamp eligibility at 14. If you have a 16-year-old, God help you. I think they go through a loaf of bread a day.
Well, I think it was one of the points when they were talking about they were going to send half the benefits after the first court order, and you think, well, okay, I mean, that's better than nothing, I guess, but it is what they're receiving wasn't enough in the first place, so then you half that and it becomes quite insignificant.
Yeah, I think for most households, the SNAP benefits cover about a third of food needs for the month, so that's still a significant reduction in how much food. And that's in addition to losses to Head Start programs that had also cut food programs, breakfast programs. The federal government is also cutting access to other ways that kids were getting fed in before school and after school programming. And these kids were already on the edge, right? They're already food insecure. To start with, I mean, a third is the highest amount, really, that you're getting in a household of their needs. So any further reduction is having a outsized impact.
I seem to recall when this program was called food stamps, I think you used the phrase food stamp. Now it's SNAP, I guess, is an acronym, and maybe they think it's more palatable. But critics of food stamps, among the things that they were critical was the notion that people were using the food stamps to buy beer and cigarettes. I don't know if that was true then, and if it was true then, whether it's still true now, but there are still some notions out that there are people who don't want to spend or don't want to support food stamps or SNAP because they believe that it's money that's being wasted.
Well, the cards are very specific.
Can I just, the average household has like a personal debt load of $100,000 in this country. Like, people are buying cigarettes and alcohol with credit card debt. So the moral, high road here is not as clear cut as people think it is when they scale back and think a little more critically about how regular people spend money they don't have, which is what debt is.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a couple letters, and then we'll move on to another topic. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this day, the 13th of November. And let's see, we welcome you. And I want to just get a couple of letters that we had on the topics that we talked about in the first hour. And then we'll move on to other topics, although we're not going to stray too far because we are going to talk about homelessness. Teresa says Snap doesn't cover alcohol or smoking products, among other things. People who negatively judge Snap users should rather look within to ask themselves what they feel the need to judge less fortunate folks. Then we go to Barbara. This makes it pretty clear. I don't look at the price of every item as I put it in the cart. However, the total at the checkout, well, that's very, very obvious. I'm single, I'm retired, I'm a senior, I'm buying food and groceries only for myself once a week. Many months ago, rarely more than $100 at checkout. Now, average $140, buying the same stuff. That's from Barbara.
Yeah, that's what I was saying when we were off air. My experience is exactly the same. I spend about $100. I used to spend about $100. Now it's about $120.
I think you can tell from, obviously, as she said, the total, yeah, which is true, but also the total and how many bags you're carrying out. Because you used to, for the total, used to carry out more bags. And so that's another way to notice that, obviously. And that's if you remember to bring the bags in.
Yeah, I like to get behind someone with a full cart and just watch their total grow and grow and be amazed when they get a total. Because I don't usually have a full cart, but it's just I would love to interview cashiers to say, what's the biggest bill you ever got?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you are a journalist. I mean, isn't that that's kind of like a Price is Right thing. It's you know, guess how much this is going to be. Yeah. Let's see. Will our federal taxes go down significantly since the government won't be supporting any of these programs? Well, you're going to get $2,000 maybe. Who knows? I know that's from tariffs, but...
Did you get your check from the state yet?
No.
You know, but some people have gotten $200 checks from New York State. That's true.
I got $400.
I got nothing.
I think you will. I think everybody who's filed a tax return gets one.
Whether you want it or not. I don't know. I haven't seen that come through.
Yeah, I asked if Kathy Hochul signed them, and the person who got the check said, yeah, it was signed by Kathy Hochul.
No, I didn't notice. I cashed it before they changed their minds.
My wife called me when we were talking on the phone yesterday when I was driving home, and I was looking at the Northern Lights. Kelly said to me, oh, we have a check here from the federal government. And I said, oh, I wonder what that is. And she said, would you like me to open it? And I said, sure, open it up. And it was for $135. And I said, well, did we overpay something? What did we do? And this is obviously isn't the $2,000, right? And it turns out that this was my reimbursement for doing federal jury duty for the day that I went
in.
Wow. Yeah.
That was fast.
Yeah, not bad.
And a shutdown?
And
yeah.
How much was it?
Yeah, like $130.
Oh, that's a lot of money for a
It's 70 cents a mile, and then they pay you whatever. It's $75 a day or whatever it is. So, yeah. That's.
And you were rejected as a juror.
I was rejected. The case just finished up. So if I had been chosen, I would have been on there for a really long time. Mm. Well, almost 3 weeks. But yeah, it's all over now. So
no, your taxes are not going to go down because of the.
The point. Thank you, Judy. The point of what I'm saying is if you can get on a jury, you can get some checks.
I'm surprised there's that much money. I thought jury duty was like $20 a day or something like that.
Because this is also the district.
The mileage
federal you're going pretty much from Kingston to Plattsburgh, for God's sake. So people are driving in. But anyway, as a mother of six, writes Jane, I can attest that grocery prices have gone up substantially. And can we talk about shrinkflation? Half the groceries I get are in smaller packages, which do not go unnoticed to the discerning mom. You know, this shrinkflation thing is fascinating to me because they're sneaky about it. And I've noticed this in two ways. One is Ira brought this up earlier about a can of tuna fish. But I was buying tuna fish over the week, and we had a recipe, and it called for 2 5-ounce cans. And it was from a brand that had the recipe. Well, that brand doesn't make a 5 ounce can anymore.
Is it 3.5? I think
it's like 4.1 or something like that. So I'm like, well, all right. Does that still? Do I need to get 3 or what do I? I don't know how to do the math on that one. The other one I like is there's a popular chain out there. I get hot chocolate when I go, but you can get coffee or whatever it is that you want. And the large, let me see your cup, Judy. This is from Stewart's. But see, there's just a lip on the bottom. This lip goes up like half of my index finger on the bottom of the cup. So like the bottom of the cup is maybe like a third of the way up. Well, that's shrinkflation too, right?
Yeah. Oh, ice cream, cereal boxes.
Well, you know,
Jane, we hear you.
Some of the reason you're not going to see lower taxes is that the spending isn't slowing at the federal level. They've increased the debt ceiling or raised the debt ceiling. And while they are cutting funding to social safety nets, they're increasing tax breaks for wealthy people and for businesses, and they're also increasing subsidies to large industries like farm industries and so on. So instead of seeing that money come back into our economy locally or into our communities through SNAP benefits, which has an economic impact of $1.50 to $2 per SNAP dollar in a local grocery store, fun facts, it just gets scooped out of the economy entirely. So your taxes, it's just an extraction of wealth from the American public to corporate entities.
What's the deficit now? A trillion? Does it reach that level?
Yeah, the Big Beautiful Bill increased the debt ceiling to $5
trillion. $5
trillion. Raising it to $41.1 trillion.
So, and Trump wants to give $2,000 of alleged receipts from tariffs to Americans rather than put, let's just presume that number is an accurate one. Why would he not want to help build down the debt?
Well, I think that move is actually related to some expectation that SCOTUS is going to strike down the tariffs and require refunds. Instead of trying to identify some amount of refund, the federal government is just kind of rounding up to everybody. So the person who has spent very little on tariffed products and the person who has spent very much on tariffed products, everyone gets $2,000. That being said, I think what does happen in grocery stores or in markets is the tariffs impact maybe 10% of the products, but everybody raises their prices because they know somebody has to pay it. So everyone is raising prices, even if they aren't themselves impacted by tariffs, because the cost of other things have gone up and they now know that's the floor. The floor is set by the tariffs, which is just a tax pass-through.
All right, let's move on, as I said, slightly, as we look at a homeless funding shift. This reporting from the New York Times and taking a look at HUD's plan. The Trump administration has developed plans for a wholesale shift in homelessness policy that would slash support for long-term housing programs, according to a confidential grant-making plan, and critics say it could quickly place as many as 170,000 formerly homeless people at risk of returning to the streets. Pivoting from housing aid, the administration's approach would shift billions to short-term programs that impose work rules, help the police dismantle encampments, and require the homeless to accept treatment for mental health or addiction. The expected shift, which would be the most consequential in a generation, is detailed in a 100-page notice from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, slated for release in coming days, that would govern more than $3.5 billion in continuum of care funds, the main source of federal money for homelessness. While President Trump has long pledged to pursue tougher homelessness policies, such as camping bans and treatment mandates. The long-anticipated document reviewed by the New York Times outlines changes that would go much deeper, much further, and much faster than originally expected.
Yeah, so it is really important. There's a lot of nuance in the new rules that get a little bit difficult to parse out. And I mentioned some overview early on, but I just want to start a little further back. If you go to the HUD website and you look at how many permanent supportive housing beds there are by state, New York and California are the two top states with the largest number of permanent supportive housing beds. New York has 881 programs and 41,577 beds. The next closest in order is Florida with 344 programs and only 17,817 beds. What the new rules do right now, about 80% of each year's grant is sort of guaranteed to go to the existing grantees. So in New York, that's CARES New York. CARES of New York then distributes it to those 800 different programs with regional COCs and rest of state COCs. They're sort of these little networks of organizations that do homelessness prevention and homelessness work, right? Currently, CARES of New York can basically guarantee that they're going to get about the same amount in their grant funding. So they can plan ahead and they can work with the state on building supportive housing beds the state funds through its homes and community renewal programs, right? What this bill does is it turns that on its head. It will only guarantee or basically guarantee 30% of the past funding award. So programs that have been stably funded for years will no longer have that stability to rely on. And the rest of that funds will go to competitive grants, competitive grant process, which will, in this administration under its new priorities, essentially move funding from states like New York and California to states that currently do not receive very much funding for this work. Maybe, I don't know, Utah, for example, right? And so not only will there be cuts locally to the supportive housing programs that exist, but the funds that do get distributed will be removed from this state and moved entirely to different states. And I think that's really important because we have more people. And we have more homeless people. In the last year, we know in the last point in time count, there were almost twice as many unhoused families in Albany County as the year before at the same point in time count. So we're seeing homelessness already on the rise. You're seeing this disruption in other sources of household income and supportive, I guess, safety net programs. And starting January, a month and a half, the programs that house disabled people will not have funding to house those disabled homeless people. Like, I don't know how to ring that alarm bell louder.
Say it again.
Starting January, the programs in New York State and across the country that are housing disabled homeless people will not have funding.
You mean January, the coldest month of the year?
The coldest month of the year.
Yeah.
And no states can back fund those programs. They're too expensive. The state of New York already supplements homeless programs. They're already building the supportive housing units. They're already trying to build the affordable housing that potentially people could move into at some point. But there aren't even the richest states in the country can't fill that gap.
I realize it's a fool's errand to ask a question like this, but what were they thinking was going to happen? In the sense of, was there any thought to this of if you do this that this very vulnerable population is going to be literally left out in the cold?
Well, I think the administration's been clear that they want to cut air quotes, Democrat programs and programs in air quotes, Democrat states. And this, you know, would most dramatically impact the poorest people in the biggest cities and in the most populous Democrat voting states. Again, New York and California have carry more than double the programs and beds that the next third largest supportive housing state has.
You know, can they do this? I mean, was this in the Big Beautiful Bill? Do they have the legislative authority, or is this a regulatory issue that HUD can actually implement on its own without any congressional input at all?
It's regulatory, yeah. And we've been looking, like, locally, we've been looking at these proposed rules for several months.
But, you know, one of the arguments of the Trump administration has been that the regulatory agencies have too much control and that they need, you know, they need a congressional oversight at some point. But this seems to be the opposite approach to how they're going to implement these kinds of changes. And I'm interested in the fact that the plan was leaked to the New York Times, so we get the information out there. And at the end of the at the end of it, are there recommendations for what we are all going to do as a society to deal with this program come January?
I mean, I don't know that it was leaked so much. I mean, the proposed change to the rules have been available to grantees for a couple of months now. So we've been aware of this. My program doesn't do permanent supportive housing, but we partner with a lot of organizations that do permanent supportive housing. And so we've been in conversations, and there does not seem to be a way to prevent the move forward. I am hopeful that our national nonprofit associations can tackle this through litigation potentially, because those programs would have to close, and that's a pretty significant impact with very little notice. So I think, you know, I think there's some strategy happening. As far as whether, you know, what the authority is, the changes do align with the president's priorities. So let's take, for example, he has an executive order that prohibits gender ideology or federal dollars spent on gender ideology initiatives. The new rules for this HUD funding prioritizes programs that affirm that they do not promote gender ideology in their programming. So if you're a permanent supportive housing program that focuses on transgender and LGBT communities, you may face you may lose funding in a competitive bid because the priority is for an organization that does not do that work. Same with racial priorities. The new rules change, like, the criteria, the scoring that organizations that have a racial priority would lose points compared to an organization that affirms that they do not engage in racial priorities or other kinds of DEI work. And so the point system is fully within the authority of a grant-making body. They make their own point system. And previously, where the points – where you were encouraged to do DEI work, you would have had lots of other grant applications talking about how much DEI work you do and how much you work towards racial justice and racial equity. Well, now – HUD has all of your other applications. It's really hard to pretend you don't do DEI work because you've said in all these ways, this is how I've demonstrated my racial equity work. So it gives the administration a tool to target those organizations as well, even if they can submit or pull together a grant that avoids trigger words in an application today, that HUD will be able to look at their history and say, well, it's clear you actually do this other stuff and you've told us how great you are at it. So there are many ways that the new rules will impact supportive housing organizations across the country. And the nuances are really complicated. But in some ways, if there aren't other supportive housing programs, maybe they just get the funding anyway. But there has been a push, and Trump has said there's a push to fund new kinds of organizations and new bodies of nonprofits that have different priorities. And I think this is just one of those initiatives.
Couple letters real quick before we go over to a break. How many of the poor unhoused people are veterans? And I don't know that we have that exact number, but I do know that among veterans there's a large population included there. But Nick is going to
Googling
town here.
Yeah, so I don't know.
We may have a number for you before long. Also, this from Chris. It seems our illustrious president is taking the war on poverty literally, attacking and punishing the poor of this country.
About 1,180 unhoused people in New York are veterans.
Well,
which is a decline from previous years. Again, they may become unhoused now if the program that houses other homeless people is just shuttered.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and finish up the program for this morning. Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, Nick Rangel, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is very nice to have you with us. And we're going to finish up the program this morning. Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, Nick Rangel, all with us. Let's see. We go to this letter from Ginny. The conversation is terrifying regarding Trump's plan to force the unhoused. He is following Peter Thiel's plan. Look it up. He's written about it for years, and it is terrifying. We are becoming a cruel country. Nick, do you think it'll be looked at? I mean, I think that's a natural reaction for people to have, that is a cruel policy. But do you think it'll be looked at politically as a cruel policy?
Well, yeah, I think there'll be some significant backlash because one of the components of permanent supportive housing is that it is the way that people who are experiencing homelessness or who have a disability access supportive services, mental health support, addiction support, help with, you know, job training or other kinds of assistance that gets people kind of back on their feet if they were just temporarily homeless. And the narrative is that the administration wants to push people back into a workforce sooner, so in less than 2 years, instead of keeping people housed beyond that 2-year permanent threshold. And I think that there will be a pretty swift reaction, but I do think the messaging is going to be important because this administration does a pretty good job focusing on the, you know, the welfare queen type narrative, the what are people buying with their SNAP benefits, why aren't people going to work, that 16-year-old should be in the workforce not getting SNAP benefits, right? And people are still largely supportive of many of these plans. We're not seeing as massive of a shift, and it won't impact many of the people that you know. Like, you won't know, you don't know that many people who have experienced homelessness. Like, so will it be seen as cruel? Sure. Will it dramatically change voting? I don't know.
That's what I was asking. Yeah, I guess.
Well, a lot of it depends on how it's portrayed by the social media people, by Fox News. If they want to draw up a scenario, A leads to B leads to C, and C is a bad place, and they continue to drill that day after day, there's a large number of people who are going to believe it and will not be exposed to the other side.
But this is going to be a local story, too. I mean, I imagine the city of Albany is going to have to deal with this head-on. Small cities, big cities, small towns, little villages are going to have this issue to confront. I mean, the rescue squads, the emergency response agencies, anybody who deals with someone on the street, this is going to be a financial imposition on all of those small towns and cities. And if those stories are reported out and the fiscal implications are real, it could resonate with the American public.
If they're reported and if they're read or heard, or if people are exposed to that information. If they're not, if they're only exposed to the naysayers, that's what they're going to follow.
I think it'll be interesting to see how many towns and villages or cities change their own policies to become eligible for funding. Like how many cities repeal their policies around sanctuary or spending on federal enforcement activities, or how many cities adopt into anti-homelessness laws in order to maintain or receive funding for this and what I can only presume other programs.
So they'll hold their nose and do something they don't want to do, but for the greater good of taking care of these people?
I think that more and more federal funding is going to be tied to those priorities, and some cities will feel a lot of pressure to hold their nose and do what they're being told to do in order to be eligible for those federal funds, pass-through funds or direct.
All right, let's go to one more topic before we call it a morning here, and I send at least two-thirds of our panel over to do the media project. They have smiles on their faces.
Some in the media would say that's a good thing.
Yes, the media would say that. We started with this story yesterday, and I'm interested in, I don't really want to continue it, but here we go. The fallout continues over the Jeffrey Epstein emails.
Ooh.
And right. And President Trump's long friendship with Jeffrey Epstein came to an apparent end in the mid-2000s, but Mr. Epstein remained intently focused on Mr. Trump for years afterward, seeking to exploit the remnants of their relationship up until his arrest on federal sex trafficking charges in 2019. This from the New York Times. In more than 20,000 pages of Mr. Epstein's typo-strewn emails and over messages released by a congressional committee on Wednesday, Mr. Epstein insulted Mr. Trump and hinted that he had damaging information on him. By turns, gossipy, scathing, and scheming, the messages show influential people pressing Mr. Epstein for insight into Mr. Trump, and Mr. Epstein casting himself as the ultimate Trump translator, someone who knew him intimately and was, quote, the one able to take him down, quote unquote. The release of the messages instantly pushed the two men's much scrutinized relationship back into the public eye, re-energizing Democratic attacks on Mr. Trump and his Justice Department for failing to publicly disclose more information from the investigation of Mr. Epstein. The emails date to at least 2011, when Mr. Trump was a reality TV star toying with a long-shot presidential run, and Mr. Epstein was trying to rehabilitate his image after his conviction and incarceration for soliciting prostitution from a minor. The messages continue through the spring of 2019, when Mr. Trump was president and his Justice Department was building a criminal case against Mr. Epstein. The messages hint that Epstein or his advisors believe they had inside and potentially damaging knowledge of Mr. Trump's far-flung properties and business dealings. Some suggest that Mr. Epstein thought Mr. Trump knew more about his personal conduct than the president has publicly acknowledged. The trove doesn't appear to include messages from Mr. Trump or anyone purporting to speak on his behalf. The president responded on social media on Wednesday, writing that, quote, the Democrats are using the Jeffrey Epstein word
hoax.
Thank you very much. 10 points for Gryffindor. To try and deflect from their massive failures, in particular the most recent one, the shutdown in Shouty Caps. Judy Patrick.
First of all, I don't think Donald Trump ever emails, so the absence of emails from him is not remarkable. Let's not lose sight of this big issue, is the fact that teenage girls were violently sexually assaulted by a lot of men, and the only consequence for that has been that Jeffrey Epstein was charged and Ghislaine Maxwell was charged and convicted. The fact that no one else has been held accountable is still out there, and I think all those girls who are now women, they have a right to feel that the justice system, the media, and the politicians have failed them. And we talk about, well, why is this still an issue? It's still an issue because if not for the reporter at the Miami Herald, Julie Brown, this story would have been covered up and, life would have gone on. It was buried, and pieces of it remain buried. I think these 20,000 emails show that there's a lot more in Epstein's orbit than we knew about. We continue to find out new things. I mean, Epstein is a chronic liar. You can't believe him. But some of these emails, especially to Maxwell, I tend to believe because Maxwell is one of the people he did trust. So I thought it was interesting that the House Republicans thought they would bury everyone with 20,000 emails. It's taking the reporters. I think they're still combing through them. They're kind of dense to go through. And it's going to take a while for whatever to happen. I think full accounting is needed. I mean, this is an important issue. It's almost at one point the Me Too movement was being pushed back down. That we gave all the women who were making all these allegations too much credit. I think this is a way of us of our society reasserting the fact that a lot of these things are hard to prove or hard to put your finger on, but these voices need to be heard, and we need to be responsible when it comes to dealing with these events, because terrible things happen to young people every day in this country, in this world, and it's never going to stop, but at least the least we can do is try our best to bring it to light.
Yeah, I even want to know the estimates of how many victims went through the Epstein trafficking ring are as high as 1,000
right.
girls.
Yes.
As young as 11. That's 1,000 girls who were victimized by countless men, and only two people have had any sense of justice associated with those crimes. And I think we have to keep the focus on that.
Well, I mean, to the contrary to what the press secretary said yesterday about Trump being transparent, they have to release these files and let the public, a court of public opinion, decide. We know that based on what we've already heard from Trump is that he's going to call it a hoax. He's going to denounce it. And to his dying day, he will never admit that, yes, you got me, if in fact there was something to get. And at this point in time, we just need to see that material and judge for ourselves.
Right. We need to see what the Justice Department did in its investigation. Why did Epstein get such an easy sentence first time around? Why wasn't anybody else charged? I mean, this island is within the U.S. territory. It's certainly within the purview of the Justice Department. We're all waiting for the FBI files. I mean, did the FBI do a complete investigation or did they drop the ball too? We don't know unless we see what they did.
This is apropos of absolutely nothing, but I was in July. I was in Palm Beach, Florida, and West Palm Beach. And by the way, no lovelier time to be in Florida than July. Just lovely, beautiful, beautiful. And I was going into the town. You go over a bridge, and Mar-a-Lago is right there, and they don't have, you can't get near it, of course, But there is a turnoff where you can look across and see the property. And so I pulled off just to take a look, and then across the way there's this huge, amazing building project going on, but it was just enormous, absolutely enormous. And there was a man there in a tour bus who seemed like he knew what he was doing, and I said, what's going on over there? Is that a house going up? Is that a house going down? He says, oh no, that's the rebuild of the Epstein property. And when you see it, just it what I thought was remarkable about it is neighbors. It was just like when you look out over, if you're standing on the lot of Mar-a-Lago and you look just over the bay there, there it is, you know. And it's and I know that's again nothing, but it was it sort of brought the two. And the relationship together to me.
We know Trump and Epstein knew each other. We know they hung out with each other. We've seen video evidence, and that doesn't mean that Trump was a pedophile, but it does mean that he saw who Epstein was. I don't know that he saw what Epstein was doing, but to distance himself entirely from Epstein just seems to be the wrong move, because we already know that he was close enough to have spent a lot of time with him.
And let's make the point that this was an issue he pounded on for when he was running for office, that, you know, he encouraged his supporters to consider this a conspiracy, and that he was going to get into it and he was going to make these things transparent. And then he gets into office and all of a sudden no need to release any information. So this is a crisis of his own making.
We are out of time. My thanks to everyone for your letters, for your interest, for your listening, and of course to our wonderful panel who were here and offered their thoughts and concerns. Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, Nick Rangel, thank you all.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.